For the Buddha, after many years of demanding ascetic practices and him perfecting many different meditation techniques, he realized that he had not found the peace that he was looking for. And a memory arose in his mind. He remembered sitting under a rose apple tree, watching his father overseeing a ploughing festival, I believe. And he remembered a spontaneous kind of happiness that had come over him those many years before. A state of absorption, we might say, a unification of heart and mind. And recollecting this experience, his instincts told him that this might be the path that he should follow. That freedom from suffering was not to be found in the demanding practices he and his other fellow wanderers had been engaged in. Until this point, the Buddha had been focusing on the denial of pleasure and on denying the needs of his body. And it was said that he was almost on the verge of death and that he could feel his backbone through his stomach. He was so thin. And you may have seen some of the Buddha images which show this emaciated skeletal figure, showing the Buddha in this state before he realized that this was not the way to happiness. Many of us have become interested in spirituality because we recognize that there might be a better way to live than the way we've been living so far. It might be through an encounter with our own suffering that we develop the desire for more freedom, the desire for a deeper rest. For myself, I was inspired by a teacher that I met. In that first meeting, it was clear to me that I'd been missing something important in life, that there was a deeper rest available than I had been able to achieve through anything else that I had done. I'd worked, I'd studied, I'd spent nearly a year traveling through India. I'd spent time in Himalayan villages, I'd been trekking, exploring fascinating cities, food, endless train journeys and culture. And yet I was restless, always thinking that I would be able to rest when I got to the next place or had the next experience, usually a different one to the one I was having in that moment. The rest that I sensed was possible in that first meeting with my teacher was beyond any familiar understanding available to me at that time. Beyond intellectual knowledge, not even an experience that I could hold on to. More of a subtle intuitive knowing and a resonance in the heart that was completely unexpected for me. And although this first meeting with my teacher was profound and inspiring, looking back, I can see that I soon reverted to familiar ways of trying to find happiness, of trying to find rest. I read books, I listened to talks, I tried to meditate, I chanted, and I went back to India for another year. Unconsciously, I'd set out on a journey of trying to change myself. And in doing so, I inevitably tried hard to be more spiritual, to be more happy. But of course, the same patterns of greed, hatred, and delusion invisibly coloured my seeking. Even though I visited many temples and places of pilgrimage, and I met with teachers, and I thought about enlightenment, All of this activity caused me to overlook my immediate experience. My relationship was difficult. Traveling in India was stressful at times. And I had unconsciously embarked on a project of accumulating more knowledge rather than in deepening in wisdom. And it took some years, actually. It took some years to find my way onto a meditation retreat at Gaia House in Devon. And even then, it took a few more retreats before I was able to develop enough mindful awareness to explore my experience rather than be lost in it, rather than to be thinking about what was happening to me. And it's an easy trap to fall into, to aspire to transcendent and non-ordinary states of consciousness, spiritual experience, bliss, awakening. I found myself fantasizing about longer retreats with different teachers, maybe joining a monastery, completely unaware that this activity of mine meant that I was not really present. I was missing my experience in the moment. If we reject mundane, everyday experiences, we miss the deep rest that is available to us if only we can put down our busyness and our striving. So our time here together today might be more helpfully thought of as spiritual relaxing rather than spiritual striving. Even the name that we give to this, spiritual practice, it's like practice. It's like hard work sometimes. So to find a deeper rest, we need to be right where we are, in this moment, with this mind, with this heart, with this body. To begin where we are. To openly and non-judgmentally examine what our experience is really like, rather than the ideas we have about how it should be, how we'd like it to be, how it used to be. And in order to do this, we need to relax. And we need to relax because this is what helps us to see what is true for us, both on and off the cushion. Not taking a position, but seeing clearly what leads to suffering and what ends it. So we pay attention to our life, to the actions of our body, speech and mind, not because we want to judge and compare ourselves, even if that happens, but because we want to know our experience, because it has something to teach us. Our experience has the potential to lead onwards, however imperfect or awakened we might judge ourselves to be. And there are a number of ways that support a deep rest, a number of ways in which we can really nourish our capacity for relaxation and settling. The first of these is through contact with earth. Contact with ground. And you may have heard the phrase that we are not human beings having a spiritual experience, but we are spiritual beings having a human experience. And so our realization of the deepest insights of the Buddha requires that we are fully landed in the here and now, in our human experience, in the immediacy of being on this earth, of being part of earth, an expression of nature. The traditional five elements, earth, air, fire, water, and space, are seen as comprising our entire reality our entire existence. That's all we are. Earth, air, fire, water, space. So to be deeply grounded in our human worldly experience is necessary in order that we can know something beyond it. If we don't know the ordinary, how can we possibly hope to know the extraordinary? Some of us have a tendency towards the transcendent, and we show little interest in the here and nowness of our experience. Others of us are more preoccupied with the dramas of our everyday lives, asleep to the possibility of something bigger than the contracted sense of self. A connection with Earth supports a more grounded and graduated exploration of our experience. We have to be here in this body. On the night of his awakening, it is said that the Buddha touched the earth. He reached down and he touched the earth in order to steady himself and claim his right to awakening in the midst of a barrage of attacks from Mara, the personification of the forces that lead away from awakening. Our own connection with earth can simply be to feel the weight of our body resting on the floor or the chair or the cushion. Or it might be to do our walking meditation outside, where we feel the wind on our face and the ground underneath. To sense the vastness of the sky above us. Perhaps we also need to reach down to touch the earth in the midst of our practice when things are difficult. To rediscover a sense of ground, a sense of presence. A sense of here and nowness. Reminding ourselves that we are here, dedicated and committed to really understanding what needs to be understood if we are to find a deep rest. The second support for resting deeply is our body. We are human beings and we are embodied. And the first of the four foundations of mindfulness is mindfulness of the body, this place where we begin our investigation by exploring the aliveness of the body, attending to breath, attending to sensation, simplifying our experience just into how it feels in the body. We might feel stressed. What's that like? Ah, sense of pressure, sense of not having enough. We want to simplify rather than create complexity. So we want to let our awareness penetrate ever deeper into our embodied experience, to allow awareness to know our experience directly, rather than being mediated by thoughts and ideas about what should or shouldn't be happening. This awareness of our embodied experience is an important component of deep rest. And we can start to sense that the awareness itself is also a refuge. That however comfortable or uncomfortable our body is, awareness is not disturbed by all that arises in it. Most of us have unconscious patterns of tension and holding in both body and mind. Our nervous systems are always alert for danger, ready to galvanize us to protect ourselves, to escape. And if we sense that there is a tension or a holding in body or mind, we can consciously aim to relax this. And I'm mentioning in mind here because body and mind are inextricably linked. When there is tension in the mind, there is usually tension in the body, and vice versa. So if our way in is through the mind, When there is tension, what is helpful is to offer ourselves a few words of loving kindness. The simple phrases, may I be happy, may I be well, may I be free from pain and suffering, may I live with ease. This can really support a softening, an ease, a relaxation. Or we can drop in a single word into our experience, like kindness or care or ease. And we offer the mind the opportunity to be more free. And if our way in is through the body, we can notice the tension or the holding, and we can offer the same phrases towards the physical sensations. And we can consciously relax any tension, inviting our body to soften, inviting our system to open and settle. So we want to be kind and gentle with both body and mind, to be kind and to be sincere with our intention, to release all the ways in which we harden and constrict ourselves, to release all the ways that prevent us from resting more deeply. The third support for resting more deeply are the practices and teachings that we're engaged with. And although it's more than 2,500 years ago since the Buddha walked on this earth, the teachings and practices left behind are simply referred to sometimes as a handful of leaves. And these are what take us on our path towards a deeper rest. So in terms of practices, we attend to our experience in four postures: sitting, standing, walking, and lying down. Not because one is better than another, but because these are the four postures that we must inhabit as we move in our lives. And so we train ourselves to be awake, to be present in these postures, and to find rest in these postures, because this is our life. Our practice is also supported by the many, many teachings that the Buddha offered. The Four Foundations of Mindfulness, the Four Noble Truths, and the Eightfold Path are just the key ones in this tradition. It is often said that awakening is like a bird with two wings. Without the full development of both wings, the bird will fly in circles. One of those wings is wisdom. We develop wisdom by meeting our experience and exploring it, seeing that all experience has three common characteristics. To see that all experiences contain an element of suffering, that all experiences are impermanent, and that wherever we look, we cannot find an ongoing, continuous, solid sense of self. I want to read you a quote from Ajahn Chah, one of the well-known monks, a well-known abbot in the Thai forest tradition. Ajahn Chah said, "It's not just by sitting with your eyes closed that you develop wisdom. Ears, eyes, nose, tongue, body, and mind are always with us, so be constantly alert. Reflect on your experience continually. Seeing trees or animals can all be occasions for study. Bring it all inwards. See clearly within your own heart. If some sensation makes impact on the heart, witness it clearly for yourself. Don't simply disregard it." So all experience is part of our practice. Whether that's anger, fear, disgust, sleepiness, dullness, agitation, worry, pain, ease, pleasure, happiness, sexual arousal, shame, loss, grief, boredom, even. So the first wing is wisdom. The second wing is compassion. We have teachings and practices that cultivate beautiful qualities of heart and mind. The Brahma Viharas, which are loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy and equanimity. These positively condition our hearts and minds so that we are more sensitive and more responsive to life. Kindness towards oneself is so necessary. So necessary because we need to be resourced in order to do this difficult work of meeting our experience, of meeting the pain, the suffering, the confusion, meeting our ability to not be able to rest. If we can be compassionate and kind towards ourselves and all that arises in this heart and mind, we have a greater capacity for meeting suffering in all its forms, in other people, in the world, and we can find a deeper rest. And the fourth support is generosity. Generosity is fundamental to the Buddha's teaching and this path of awakening. The Pali word dana, D-A-N-A, which often gets translated as giving, and I'll say a little bit more about dana in that sense later on. But it also means generosity. And this is towards oneself and towards all others and towards all experience. Not just those experiences or those people who we already like. Generosity is an important part of cultivating an ease of being. And equanimity and generosity are antidotes to self-absorption and fear. It's generosity that opens our heart and connects us with others and with ourselves. And generosity is also an antidote to feeling like we don't have enough. Rather than feeling a lack, we have a sense that there is more than enough to go round, and that to be generous is not reducing our limited resources. Often we feel contracted. We feel reluctant to share what we have, whether it's our time, our money, our possessions, our space. We can fear that we will somehow become impoverished. The practice of generosity is how we challenge these fears. And being generous, we get to see that the heart feels good when we give, when we share, when we offer. And that actually it's our resistance to generosity, based in fear, that closes us down and makes us feel more separate and more alone. So within the Buddha's teaching, generosity is a stepping stone to greater understanding, to patience, to equanimity, and to care. It's also central to a sense of integrity, because it's generosity that allows us to align our actions with our deepest understanding and enact kindness into the world, rather than have our actions guided by fear and insecurity. This is necessary at every level, at every stage of the journey, starting with our own hearts and minds, but extending outwards towards our families, our communities, to nations and the whole of humanity. Generosity helps us find a deeper rest as we renounce the mind states of greed and stinginess, The Buddha spoke about worldly and unworldly feelings. Practicing generosity is a gateway to happy, unworldly feelings. Feelings that are based on renunciation and letting go. Unworldly feelings do not condition us to experience further rounds of suffering. Generosity is also one of the 10 paramis, the 10 perfections of heart and mind. These 10 qualities that support us in awakening. The first of them is generosity. And I'll just run through them briefly. The second is morality, to live an ethical life. Thirdly, renunciation. Fourth, wisdom. Fifth, energy. Sixth, patience. Seventh, truthfulness. Eighth, determination. Nine, loving kindness. And 10, equanimity. The Buddha emphasized the value of generosity in his well-known teaching, where he said that if we knew as he did the fruits of giving, we wouldn't let a single meal pass without sharing it. From a self-centered point of view, generosity might seem like it mostly benefits the receiver. Generosity also brings benefit to ourselves as the one who offers something to another. It frees us from stinginess. It frees us from self-centeredness. This is not only in the moment when there's a certain quality of openness in our hearts and minds, but also when the wholesome fruits of our actions bear further fruit in the future. Every time we give, we are strengthening the qualities of loving kindness and renunciation. By consciously focusing on the practice of generosity, we see the benefits ever more deeply and wisdom takes a deeper root in us. Generosity gladdens the heart and brightens the mind, making us more receptive and more open to hear the teachings of liberation. So let's just take a breath for a moment before I continue. Sense your experience, sense your body, including your arms and your legs. Check that you are really here. So in this second part of the talk, I want to begin by talking about two ways of seeing the path, two ways of seeing, two perspectives that inform our practice. The first one is seeing the spiritual path as a journey. When we see it as a journey, we start somewhere and we get to somewhere else. And on that journey, we learn, we evolve, and hopefully something changes and we become different in some way. Really useful, really valuable to see our path in this way. Second perspective, second way of seeing is that what we are seeking can also be known in the now. But what we are seeking can be known in the now. From this perspective, what we want is already here. So what separates us from the rest that we deeply, deeply desire is the view that our experience is somehow wrong, different, or needs improving upon. And from this view, all we need to do is to relax into the now, to simply be here. Not to change anything, not to grow, not to go on a journey. To be more simple, uncomplicated, direct, present, and awake. In both perspectives, the sense of the spiritual path as a journey, or what we are seeking, is here now. There's a desire to be someone or something. And in the Buddha's teachings, this is known as bhava tanha, craving to become, desiring to become. And if we see awakening as a journey, we overlook what is here now, because where we want to get to is somewhere in the future. However, if we try and jump ahead into the immediacy of the now, we run the risk of bypassing our personal, our historical, and our psychological histories. We might also fail to notice the more subtle forces of greed, hatred, and delusion that still operate, even when we are not aware of being reactive. So bhava tanha, this craving to become, often driven by a deeper sense of I am not good enough. And many of us know this in our lives. On a deep, deep level, we don't feel good enough just as we are. We need more education. We need more meditation. We need more money. We need a different kind of personality. We need to be less reactive. We need a different body. And in our meditation practice, this translates as a kind of pressure to change ourselves. To be more peaceful, to be wiser, to be more compassionate. These don't sound that risky. These don't sound like these are going to trip us up. But when we have this idea about needing to be different, our meditation practice is full of judgments about the way that we are already being. And it's not that such thinking, to be more peaceful, to be more wise, to be more compassionate, it's not that it doesn't motivate us in wholesome ways, but it can become a compulsion. It can become a stick to beat ourselves with, and then we miss the contentment and the rest that is already here. Because unknowingly we've embarked on a project of changing ourselves to become more spiritual or good or nice or better, however we language it. So our challenge is not to get rid of desire, but rather to illuminate it with awareness. And so both perspectives, the path as a journey and being here now, they both have a value. On the relative level, yes, there is a journey in time and space that we embark upon during the course of our lives. And over time, yes, we spiritually grow and mature. But in reality, this is more of a letting go than an accumulation, and a putting down of what gets in the way. It's a relinquishment and a renunciation that allows us to rest in the now. So what is it that we need to put down? What is it we need to let go of? In his first sermon, the Buddha spoke of three fires that are burning. The fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. And earlier this year, I was at the very site of this first teaching in Sarnath in India with my family. Quite amazing to think that some 2,600 plus years ago, this was the very spot. And he shared this teaching with his friends on the path, friends who actually had sort of disowned him because he had given up mortification of the body. He'd given up his ascetic practices. He'd gone soft. These three forces, these three fires of greed, hatred, and delusion, they corrupt our understanding and they colour actions of body, speech, and mind. And this corruption means that we perpetuate many cycles of suffering in our lives. Putting out the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion supports resting deeply in our human experience and lets us taste nibbana, complete freedom, the complete going out of greed, hatred, and delusion. Letting these fires go out, the cooling out of these fires. This supports resting deeply in our human experience. A deep rest that is beyond all concepts, beyond all ideas. In the words of the Buddha, to be experienced by the wise. I've spoken a number of times about relaxation, or I've mentioned it in the meditation instructions. And we all probably have an intuitive sense of what it means to relax. Often means, I don't know, to lie down, to surf the internet, to watch a film, to go to bed. But what we're really talking about here and what the Buddha was pointing to was relaxing the sense of self that lies at the root of all suffering. This craving to be or craving not to be. Craving to be a better, new or improved kind of self. And its opposite, the craving not to be. Vibhava tanha, wanting to disappear. To fade away, to not be noticed, to diminish our human experience. Unknowingly, we are almost continually reacting to our experience, trying to look good, to improve ourselves, to be more spiritual, reacting to this inner sense of not feeling good enough. And at other times, we're trying to avoid our experience. We want to deny the reality of our confused and conflicted hearts. We want to rise above the messiness of this human life. None of this is wrong, but it is a misguided attempt to try and get somewhere else, to find a place of rest. Right intention, one of the Eightfold Path factors, is important here. This path that leads to awakening. An intention is really the attitude or the inclination of mind on which we base our actions. It's significant because it affects how we see things. If we hold a negative intention, we see things in a negative light. However, if we have a positive intention, the heart feels clear and unobstructed. And we know the difference, don't we? We know when we've spoken, even tinged by anger or resentment or jealousy or fear. Understanding this principle of cause and effect, that negative intentions tighten us, constrict us, and we see the world differently. Understanding this leads us to right view. Often our minds think, oh, well, that's not so difficult. I just need to sort that out. It feels like it should be easy for us to follow this principle. However, we get seduced by attractive and pleasant experiences and we want to hold on to them, or at least to avoid losing them. And of course, we're all familiar with wanting to avoid or reduce unpleasant experiences. So right intention doesn't only come from the mind. It's not simply a question of will, but rather it comes from a seeing in the depths of our heart what leads to suffering and what ends it. When we see clearly, when we can see in which directions our intention leads, do they lead towards freedom and rest, or do they lead towards further suffering? We can all see this. We can all get ever more sensitive to how this principle operates in our lives. In all of us, we will see both wholesome and unwholesome intentions arise. And we want to know both. We want to know both because neither are wrong, neither are right. But they lead in different directions. And we want to steer a wise path and live a balanced life. So we want to relax any tensions that reinforce a sense of self. Intentions that are concerned with being better or looking good. Not only is keeping up appearances hard work, but it takes us into the territory of the eight worldly winds. And these are presented as four pairs: gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute, pleasure and pain. And if we consider any of these pairs, we can see how necessary a sense of balance is. If we take refuge in gain, then loss will be harder to bear. If we get filled up on praise, a moment of criticism is so painful and deflating. We know the difficulty of blame. We know the difficulty of loss. We know the difficulty of ill repute. We know the difficulty of pain. Often the way that we invest in the upsides of life is a less conscious process. We aren't so aware of this. We don't see the danger. We simply feel like this is how life should be, like life is working out or the gods are on our side. And we become asleep to the inevitability that things will change, that nothing lasts forever, that pleasure will give way to pain and gain will lead to loss. This is the way of the world. So there's a difference between being with our experience and being lost in our thinking about our experience. We can know our experience. Awareness can receive our experience without thinking or conceptualizing about it, without abstracting ourselves or separating ourselves from the experience. So we want to cultivate an embodied wisdom that integrates body, heart, and mind. And being with our experience helps to find a deep rest, even when our experience is not how we would like it to be. And we need to learn how embodied awareness supports us to handle all the feelings that can arise and all the thoughts that the mind can generate, because many of them are painful. If we pay too much attention to the thinking mind, then it is running the show. But when our awareness is fully embodied, a different possibility other than simply thinking about or analysing our experience becomes available. We can receive it, we can know it, we can feel the texture of it. Embodied awareness helps us to soften. It helps us widen, and we then get to include our experience rather than react to it. We learn to sense the impact on the body, impact in the whole body system. And this brings about a relaxation. Because we can just know this rather than turning it into an experience that we have to change. And we can also support a deeper rest by attending to any contractions in the body, rather than judging or complaining about them. And these contractions in the body and in the heart and in the mind, they can discharge as we bring a kind and gentle awareness to them. When we resist our experience, we suffer more. All too often, we bring our agendas for self-improvement into our meditation practice. Intention and determination can be wonderful supports for practice if utilized skillfully. But deep rest isn't found in striving. It isn't found in forcing, and it isn't found in judging. Our awareness needs to both attend to and relax whatever isn't needed, to allow more spaciousness, to allow body, heart, and mind to settle and to feel more at ease. And you may have noticed this in your meditation practice when the awareness was bigger, more spacious, wider, unlimited, unconstrained. And you may have noticed the pressure that builds up when we contract around our experience, even a pleasant one. We lose contact with the vastness that we are. And so part of the reason that meditation practice is so helpful is that we get a taste of the different ways that we can be, that are profoundly different to our everyday ways of operating in the world. Often operating from a place of fear, of insecurity, of not being enough. In relaxing our thinking, we relax and soften our bodies, we relax and soften our minds, and we soften and relax our views of self. And when our view of self softens, so do our views of other and the world. And then we have the possibility of seeing how this apparent, solidly real reality, this unquestioned sense of a separate you, a separate me, inside, outside, good, bad, better, worse, gets created. And we can then start to see ever more clearly that this is how we suffer. So finding deep rest does not depend on having conditions arranged the way that we think they need to be. It is easier to be restful when conditions are perfect, that's true. But conditions are rarely perfect. And all conditions are subject to change. So we need to develop both wisdom and compassion in order to meet an imperfect world. We need wisdom and compassion to meet our imperfect minds and our imperfect bodies. Resting deeply requires that we see the changing conditions of inner and outer worlds simply as that, as conditions that are impermanent and subject to change. When we fail to see the true nature of all experience, we are ensnared, we are entranced, we struggle, and we inevitably suffer. So can we relax? Can we release? Can we let go into what is here right now? Can we relax, release, and let go into the deep rest that is closer than our very breath? Not somewhere else, not in somebody else, not in another time, another place. Close to the now very breath. Let's sit for a few moments.